This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This morning you're in Australia.
I am, yes.
Does this have anything to do with your work on climate change, or is this a entirely different project you're working on now?
No, this has everything to do with my work on climate change. Australia is a country that's extremely vulnerable among developed nations to the impacts of climate change.
Well, maybe we can talk a little bit about that towards the end, but we're going to talk about California
sure.
to start with. Now, over the last few days, measurements have detected that the parts per million in the atmosphere of carbon dioxide have now reached 400. A number which is very chilling because we're getting closer and closer to the point of no return where no matter what we do to mitigate our carbon emissions and other greenhouse gas emissions, we're not going to be able to stop this freight train that's just rolling on towards demise. So let's talk a little bit about why it's so imperative that states like California actually have taken steps to mitigate climate change and why it's important for the United States as a nation and the rest of the nations in the world to follow.
Yeah, well, California really has gone it alone in a lot of ways. California set up a program, this program called Cap and Trade, to try to create an economic incentive for industries to change their behavior and produce less carbon dioxide, because to date, industries around the world, for the most part, you know, with the exception of a similar program in Europe, have been able to emit carbon dioxide pretty much for free, and have not had to pay for the cost that has for the rest of us living on this planet, the cost that it, you know, the impact that it has in terms of global warming. And that has a lot to do with why, you know, little has changed in terms of the amount of global output of carbon dioxide. In fact, emissions continue to rise.
Now, what makes the California regulations different from other kinds of compacts that have been agreed upon by northeastern states, which are actually in the forefront a few years ago of taking at least any steps at all to try to combat climate change?
Yeah, the regulations in the Northeast are really focused on power plants. California has put together a huge package of regulations and incentives that include both setting up a carbon market, but also include measures to do with renewable energy, to do with transportation, to do with all of the kinds of transformations that the California economy will need to see to become greener.
So why, the title of your article in The Nation is, Will California's Cap and Trade Be Fair? Why is that a concern? What is lurking beneath the surface of the new laws that makes some environmental justice advocates in particular concerned that this is not really going to address some very very severe pollution problems in a lot of communities of color in particular?
Yeah, well, I think the thing is that cap and trade is based on the idea that emissions can happen anywhere and they're roughly equivalent. So it's focused really specifically on carbon dioxide, which by itself doesn't cause health problems. And I think because it's kind of a market-based policy or an economic policy, the idea is that it sort of creates a kind of abstract mechanism for regulating carbon dioxide emissions. So, you know, carbon dioxide emissions, the rights to emit them can be traded all over the economy. But the trouble is that the combustion of fossil fuel isn't just an abstraction. If you refine oil, when you use coal or gas to generate electricity, when you burn fuel to power cars or trucks or ships, that's a dirty fuel. And at the same time that you're producing greenhouse gases, you're producing other kinds of pollutants, like sulfur dioxide, which causes everything from headaches to lung damage, and soot, which is linked to heart attacks and asthma, and other kinds of toxic emissions that are linked to neurological disorders. And those problems aren't actually equally distributed in California. Millions of Californians live within a few miles of a major industrial facility that produces both greenhouse gases and all of these other kinds of pollution. And that population is disproportionately lower income and composed of people of color. So the burden of that pollution, the burden of our fossil fuel economy, falls most heavily on a certain group of people. And those communities and activist groups working in those communities feel that as California starts to make a transition to a green economy, it's only fair that those communities should see the benefits of cap and trade, sorry, not of cap and trade, but of AB 32, of the law, come to their communities.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the mechanism of cap and trade, because I think it's still kind of a mystery to a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
And I've talked with people who are strong environmental advocates who really support cap and trade. I've also talked to people who think that it's barely, I was reading some of the responses to your article online on The Nation, and people who think it's just a scam and it's a house of mirrors or whatever. So let's talk about what the mechanism is and then some of the problems that come because it's market-based.
Yeah, so cap and trade is a system that's existed for a few decades. It was used to try to reduce acid rain. And it's based on the idea that you set up a market to trade the rights to emit a particular pollutant. And then you allow particular companies leeway to decide, are they going to buy enough permits to pollute? Are they going to trade permits with other companies that have reduced their emissions? Are they going to reduce emissions on site so that they don't have to buy as many permits? And then across the entire system, so in the case of AB 32, which is the law that is California's big comprehensive climate law, which includes the cap and trade program, across the entire state of California, there's a cap on how much carbon dioxide can be emitted over the whole state. And the cap is supposed to ratchet down every year, but the emissions can come from all over the place. And including in one of the more controversial parts of the law, they can come from offsets, which are projects that, you know, aren't really even part of these sectors of the economy, part of these industrial sectors of the economy. They can come from forestry, or they can come from agriculture, and they can come from anywhere in the country. A project that has committed to reducing carbon in some way, but that project may not actually have direct benefits within California.
So let's talk a bit about how carbon offsets work. I mean, this is exactly the same thing on a larger industrial scale as, like, if I were going to fly to where you are in Perth, Australia, I could buy some carbon offsets along with my airline ticket, which would at least assuage my guilt for having such a large carbon footprint because I'm going to fly to Australia. So is it a similar kind of thing, or is there a difference between the kind of offsets you buy to when you're flying and the kind of offsets that industries buy?
There is a difference. The kind of offsets you buy when you're flying are voluntary. And so when you buy those offsets, you're supporting a project that is supposed to be reducing carbon somewhere in the world. In California, when you're buying an offset, if you're an industry that's regulated under the law, you're buying something that gives you credit for having reduced emissions, but it's actually somebody else who allegedly reduced those emissions or perhaps planted a certain number of trees that are supposed to take up carbon dioxide at a certain rate. And that frees you up from having to make those reductions on site.
Well, this morning we're talking with Madeline Ostrander, who is the senior editor of Yes Magazine, and she wrote an article in February in The Nation magazine called "Will California's Cap and Trade Be Fair?" So this morning we're sort of sorting through what cap and trade means, which is something we've discussed on this program a number of times, and I think a lot of people are confused by it. And we're going to talk especially about some of the built-in inequities, particularly race, class, social inequities built into cap and trade when it comes down to who benefits and who is not benefiting from pollution reduction. So one of the things that you mentioned in the beginning of the show is that there's a big difference between controlling for carbon dioxide emissions, which actually are not poisonous in themselves, and what's often used as a reason for touting cap and trade is that people say, well, when we reduce our carbon dioxide emissions, we also reduce all these other ancillary emissions that are very harmful, the particulates, the toxins, the carcinogens that are emitted by fossil fuel burners. So why is there an issue for you with cap and trade? How does cap and trade sometimes inhibit that connection between reducing carbon dioxide emissions and reducing other noxious emissions?
Well, I guess one of the things is that, as I said, you know, the burden of pollution in California is not equally distributed. So, for instance, if you look at, there's a scholar from the University of Southern California, and he led a team of scholars who did an assessment of who are the worst polluters in California in terms of both their impact on human health and the amount of greenhouse gases that they emit. And if you line up the top 10, actually 5 of them are next to one community. They're all refineries, and they surround a neighborhood called Wilmington, which is a lower-income, predominantly Latino community that is one of the most toxic places in the state. Another is the Chevron Richmond refinery, which is the number one point source greenhouse gas emitter in the state. And there are communities that live around these refineries. So these refineries are having a disproportionate burden on the poor, on low-income communities, on communities of color. And they are allowed to decide under cap and trade whether or not they're going to continue buying enough permits to continue to produce the same amount of greenhouse gas emissions, whether or not they're going to engage in certain kinds of energy efficiency and fuel efficiency activities that would both reduce their greenhouse gas emissions but would also reduce pollution there on the site. And I think these communities that live around these polluters feel like there's an opportunity here to bring greener, cleaner economic development to change the way their communities work. And cap and trade doesn't really seize that opportunity because it allows these refineries to trade.
Now, in the mechanism, it seemed to be some debate about how much each of the industries in California is going to be required to reduce their actual emissions versus how much they can reduce, I'll call it virtual emissions, through cap and trading. So was there any kind of conclusive analysis about whether there's a certain percentage of emissions that really have to be controlled on site?
Yeah. Well, in terms of offsets, there is a limit. So in the first years, 8%, only 8% of an industry's of particular facilities allowances can come from offsets. So that means that if a facility emits 100 tons of carbon, 8 of their allowances, 8 of the permits that they buy can come from offsets. But the thing is that within the first few years, industries are only reducing their emissions by incremental amounts. So that means that really a lot of their first sets of reductions can come from offsets. The Union of Concerned Scientists has estimated that something like 80 to 85% of the reductions in the first several years could come from offsets, which could happen anywhere, including outside of the state of California. Groups that are involved in trading offsets say that that's really only a theoretical maximum, and that it's really unlikely, particularly since the offsets markets are kind of small. But still, I think, you know, it opens the question, is the offsets market delaying the state of California from making the kind of economic transition that the law was supposed to be all about?
Well, I've heard people actually compare the offset markets to hedge funds and derivatives. I mean, that it's seen some people talk about how Wall Street loves the carbon offset market because it's another imaginary source of money. So is there a concern that this offset market really is basically a lot of smoke and mirrors, or maybe it's like selling indulgences?
There have been groups that have been very concerned about the amount of offsets that are allowed in California and about the fact that they're allowed at all. In fact, it was the subject of a lawsuit last year. California has only allowed a small number of kinds of offsets. Sources that I've talked with say that some of the same problems that have been experienced in Europe, where offsets either, you know, weren't really, they were sort of not entirely real. In other words, an offset is supposed to be an additional amount of reduction of carbon dioxide beyond what a particular company would be doing otherwise. It's supposed to be in addition to what would happen normally. And sometimes that's really hard to evaluate and document if you're talking about tree planting or if you're talking about a company that's promised not to log some stretch of forest. And so I think there are some concerns about how the offsets market is going to work. I think California is claiming that it's been very careful and that it's made improvements since some of the problems happened in the European market, but it's not really clear yet.
So what is your sense? I mean, are you concerned? And I know your article, I felt like, raises more questions than it answers, and they're really good questions. But I wonder, since you wrote the article, if you have any more sense of some of the fears that you raise, if these are really valid fears, and that perhaps there should be thinking an alternative to cap and trade as a more dynamic vehicle mechanism for limiting carbon emissions.
I think one of the problems that's been seen in a lot of the cap and trade markets that exist in the world, both carbon markets and other kinds of markets, is that it's difficult to regulate the number of permits that are available and also the price on them. So the big problem that's happened in the European Union is that the price of carbon has collapsed, has bottomed out, and prices in Europe have been staying below about 5 euros for quite a while. When it gets to be that low, the whole point of the program, the point of creating an economic incentive for industries to make a transition, sort of disappears. And also the kinds of revenue that these governments were imagining bringing in, that they were going to invest in renewables, isn't there anymore. So I think that, you know, really one of the troubles with a cap and trade market is that it's very complex. Doesn't necessarily mean that it couldn't ever work, but the policies have been pretty rocky to date. It is, to be fair, a big experiment to try to transition an entire economy from fossil fuels over to some other way of doing business. But I think that cap and trade has been very complex, and I think that any system that's going to regulate carbon dioxide has to be designed in a way that's practical, that's measurable, that's simple, that brings tangible benefits back to ordinary people and their communities, and that's fair. And that's really been the question and the problem with cap and trade.
Well, it kind of reminds me of the Clinton health plan, you know, that instead of like having something simple like single payer, it was so convoluted and basically being run by the insurance companies. And people raise concerns that the whole cap and trade system is largely being run by Wall Street, which I don't think is true, but there's an appearance, and that seems to add one more layer of complexity to it. So one question I have is there a better way to do this than through something that's market-driven? Because that's been the mantra for the last 30 years. It's true with our land use planning laws here in Oregon. It's market-driven, basically, and it sort of works to some degree, and then there's these other funny ways around it, and it doesn't – sometimes I think it's self-defeating. So do you see that there are other methods that people are looking at that are perhaps more regulatory as opposed to market-driven?
Yeah, I will say that Brian Walsh in Time Magazine last month suggested that he said, quote, "the hope that we may be able to reduce carbon emissions the same way we cut pollutants like sulfur dioxide through a cap and trade program seems to be dimming, a victim of its own complexity." I think some people have suggested that perhaps the way to go about it is to invest more and more in renewables and in developing alternative energy. I think that I like what Bill McKibben has often said about climate change, which is that there is really no silver bullet solution, that it really is a very complex problem to try to transition an entire economy over to an entirely different way of doing business, an entirely different kind of energy, an entirely different sort of economy that isn't fossil fuel driven. So, you know, perhaps market mechanisms are one way, but they're not going to work without political will behind them. They're not going to work without very tangible things that are also happening at the community level. They're not going to work without a sort of vision behind them that can build political will, because they, in all of the countries where they've been implemented, including where I am now in Australia, they faced a lot of public controversy. And I think they can really only succeed when the public is behind them, because there's always a lot of industry pressure to weaken them. AB 32 was conceptualized in communities like Wilmington next to Los Angeles as part of this incredible vision for California's future. Activists tried to paint it as a way of creating green jobs, a way of bringing, you know, green development into California, a way of saying, instead of living next to a dirty industry, instead of living in a place where your kids have asthma and people around you are getting cancer, you can begin to build a clean economy where you have good jobs that don't make you sick, and you can begin to address the problem of climate change, but also usher in a whole different kind of economy and community. And I think that vision was really inspiring and was why a lot of these communities got behind the law, while labor unions also got behind the law and defeated an industry challenge against the law in 2010. I think that then when you try to divorce the policy from the local implications of pollution, of economic development, people lose interest and they get frustrated, and, you know, it seems less practical. And I think to some extent, California is also suffering because of that.
Well, I'm just thinking about what it's like being in one of these communities which is close to refineries. I've been spending a lot of time in Richmond, California over the last couple of years. And that's right in I'm in spending time in the neighborhood that's right in the shadow of the huge Richmond Chevron refinery. And the climate change impacts of the refinery aren't visible to people, but the particulate and noxious fumes and the fire last summer are very visible. And I wonder if there's a way to connect the two, and perhaps as a better mechanism than cap and trade, for there to be, because the idea being that if you really reduce carbon emissions, if you're doing it on site, then you're also going to be reducing all the other emissions that are so noxious to the communities.
Yeah, a lot of the environmental justice groups really want these particular facilities to have more kind of straightforward regulations, something called command and control, where they're really all required to do the same thing. So they have very specific requirements on those facilities. Economists will say, well, that's expensive. But I think the point of some of these scholars like Manuel Pastor and Rachel Morella-Frosch, who've done work on trying to quantify some of these environmental justice questions, what their work shows is that it's really a small number of facilities that are causing the largest problems. And so one of the things Pastor has suggested is that perhaps you not allow these particular polluters to trade as freely, or maybe you put a higher price on their allowances so that it's more difficult for them to trade and they have more incentive to reduce pollution locally. Or maybe you find other ways of linking the policy with tangible health benefits so that you're both accomplishing two things at once, but also you're bringing benefits to this community that they can see, that's part of what builds public support, that's part of what, you know, keeps people engaged in, inspired by this kind of law, so that it can continue to move forward, both in terms of climate change and also in terms of the public health benefits.
But in the case of like Chevron and their relationship to the city of Richmond, they have a long history of basically not just dominating the politics and the spirit of the Bay Area, but probably the entire state of California. And they do seem to have an attitude, which was really exhibited after the fire last summer, of, well, they already had their mechanism in place. They pay out a few $100 to people who apply for compensation, and then the whole thing is forgotten. And this has happened over and over and over again with all the countless fires that have happened at that plant. There's a lot of people in Richmond who'd like to change that, but it seems that Chevron has a huge mechanism in place to basically get whatever they want. And I wonder, how do we stand up to the incredible power of these behemoth corporations like Chevron?
I think that's, in a lot of ways, what's so inspiring about the California law is that it actually still exists, despite the fact that oil industry groups, including Tesoro and Valero, which are two other big companies that have refineries in California, mounted a challenge that would have basically unraveled the entire regulation and made it impossible to implement in California. And what happened was that activists organized in low-income communities across the state, organized thousands of people, did campaigns where people knocked on doors, people, you know, called up their friends and neighbors and went to the ballot box and voted down this challenge to the climate law, which would have gotten these industries, you know, completely off the hook for having really to do anything about greenhouse gases. I think, you know, now the question remains, is this market-based program to regulate industries, is it going to continue to have regulatory teeth? Is it going to be strong enough? And I think that that's really why this environmental justice constituency is so important and why thinking about the health concerns is really important for the state, because I think that, you know, that's the base of people who are going to make it possible for the state to move forward with their climate change regulations.
Well, if you have just tuned in this morning, we're talking with Seattle-based writer Madeline Ostrander, who wrote an article in The Nation a couple months ago about California's cap-and-trade aspect of their climate change legislation that was actually enacted a few years ago but was reinforced to stay in existence in 2010. In the remaining minutes that we have here, Madeline, I'd like to talk about why you're in Australia. What's going on there that you are compelled to be talking to me at 1 o'clock in the morning? Or now it's about 1:45, right?
It is, yeah. Well, part of my work is really on thinking about climate change impacts on a local level and how people are adapting to climate change. Australia is a really fascinating case study because Australia is, among developing nations, one of the most vulnerable to climate change. They've already seen incredible impacts. This past summer, there were raging wildfires and there were temperatures, record high temperatures all through the summer that were hot enough to melt asphalt in some parts of the country. And the Australian Bureau of Meteorology had to update its temperature ranges that it normally puts on its weather maps to include a whole new category of temperatures because it had been so consistently hot. So Australia is really facing some very dire questions about how to respond to climate change here. And at the same time, it's the same kinds of market policies have been very contentious. Australia does have a carbon tax, but it hasn't had a lot of public support, and it's faced a lot of resistance from industry groups. So I'm here learning from people here about, you know, what it means to be sort of on the forefront of the early impacts of climate change.
Well, I mean, I remember that Australia was also on the forefront of the early effects of the hole in the ozone. I think that one
That's
of the,
true.
And I remember Helen Caldicott, she would talk about the blind sheep in Australia. I wasn't sure. I mean, I thought that was kind of an apocryphal story, but she was one of the people who was decrying, you know, just how horrible the hole in the ozone was before people start taking it seriously and before we banned CFCs across the world. But are people, I'm assuming that people are taking the climate crisis very seriously in Australia because the impacts are so visible. And are you seeing people around you thinking, maybe starting to really rethink their values and the way that they live their lives?
The public is taking climate change very seriously. And as in the United States, because of recent extreme weather events, those events have really roused the public and made a lot of believers out of people who, you know, perhaps were previously uncertain whether climate change is real. One of the things that's true here is that 70% of the newspapers are controlled by Rupert Murdoch.
Who is Australian.
Australian, yeah. His Australian company, which is the Australian branch is called News Limited. So, you know, there is also a lot of media that gets produced that casts doubt on climate change or that simply doesn't mention it at all. And I think that has stifled the political conversation about climate change here. And hopefully, you know, there's enough public concern about that right now that that will begin to change.
Now, the government, actually, there was a big shift in the Australian government a couple of years ago. And, well, actually, I think before Obama was elected, so like 6 years ago. And is there more of a governmental concerted effort to really deal directly with climate change as opposed to the United States, where we still haven't moved after how many years we've been working on this, 20 years or whatever?
Yeah, well, I mean, the Labor Party's... So the Prime Minister, who is a Labor Prime Minister, Julia Gillard, is the first female Prime Minister in Australia. And she was able to usher in a carbon tax in 2011. And emissions did fall in 2012 by a very, very small amount, some tiny fraction of a percent, but at least they didn't grow. So you can say, yes, that Australia does at least have a national climate policy. It is at risk. The Gillard government is a little bit besieged right now and appears not to be very popular. And it's likely that Julie Gillard will not remain prime minister after the September election. So it really remains to be seen which direction Australia will go in terms of its policies to address climate change. But... I will say that there is here at least an awareness of particular kinds of issues related to climate change, and the biggest one is management of water. Water is very scarce here, and there is an awareness that drought is becoming more common, that certain kinds of impacts of climate change are becoming more common, that rainfall patterns are changing, and that's really a big concern for the public. And so one would hope that even if, you know, the Labor Party no longer remains at the helm, that public concern will be high enough that climate change policies will continue to be in effect.
Recently, I read a book by Jack Leslie about the high dams around the world, and I learned a lot about Australia I hadn't been aware of. I mean, I knew that Australia was a dry country with a much greater desert area than the United States has, but I didn't realize how tiny the river system was, nor how managed it was, and that it seems that Australia, even more so the United States, has had a long history of believing it can control its water for the use of agriculture and for human uses, and not having a very strong understanding of the need for our rivers to also remain natural to support natural systems. And I'm wondering if that consciousness is changing in Australia, because it seems like that would go hand in hand with having a stronger awareness about the need to really deal directly with climate change issues.
I think in general, I would say that Australians have a very strong sense of place and are very committed to, I would say that the Australian ecology is very much part of the national identity here, and that particular part of Australian identity has become stronger in the last several years. And, you know, I don't think you can necessarily underestimate the power of that, that ethic of taking care of the ecology does extend into the ways that environmental policies are enacted. But at the same time, Australia is in the middle of a big mining boom, particularly where I am here in Western Australia. And there's a lot of money and a lot of power behind continuing to allow the mining industry to engage in ramping up more and more resource extraction. So, you know, there's a lot of pressure not to put more regulations on industry. And those voices sometimes are louder in the political system than the rest of the public can be.
That sounds very familiar. Sounds just like the United States.
So when
you return to the States this summer, how do you plan on spreading the message of what you're learning in Australia and connecting that to our need here in the United States to wake up about the whole issue of the climate crisis?
Well, I'm working on writing a series of articles that have to do with climate adaptation and you know, Australian sensibility about protection of the environment. And I think that my hope is that those articles and stories will really resonate with people in the United States. I think that, you know, Americans have a certain amount of fascination with Australia. And I think that Australians are people that Americans can identify with. But I think that the issues here are sort of even more concentrated or dire or something, given the scarcity of water. And given how unique this place is.
And given that it seems to be in the land of vulnerability around climate change or whatever other ecological crises we've imposed upon the Earth. Well, I want to thank you very much for joining us, Madeline. It's been great talking with you. I hope we can talk again in the future. Maybe when you get back from Australia, we can talk more about what you learned there.
Yeah, that would be great.
Okay, well, we've been talking with Madeline Ostrander, who's senior editor of Yes Magazine, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed or you want your friends or family to hear this show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm. Go to the upper right-hand corner of the homepage. There's a search bar in there, and if you just put in Locus Focus and today's date, you will come up with the program with the audio. Next week, we'll be talking more about the issue of climate change and be discussing the extreme drought conditions across central United States with Christopher Williams, who is an associate professor in the Geography Department of Clark University in my hometown of Worcester, Massachusetts. I'm Barbara Bernstein. My engineer is Michael McDade. We're going to go out with some music by Joni Mitchell. Thanks for listening.
This KBOO program is made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Grendel's, a neighborhood coffee house offering organic coffee, sandwiches for breakfast and lunch, and Wi-Fi. Proud to support KBOO, Grendel's is open every day at East Burnside and 8th. Information at 503-595-9550 or grendelscoffee.com.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Community College. Portland Community College, working to make college an option for everyone and celebrating alumni who've strengthened the community. You can learn more at opportunity.pcc.edu. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The interview with writer Michael Pollan, originally scheduled for this time, has been canceled due to a change in Mr. Pollan's schedule. Health Watch is currently working to reschedule that interview and will be announcing it when it's rescheduled. Instead of Health Watch today, we'll hear a program from Food Sleuth Radio featuring an interview with Lynn Clarkson.
Hi, welcome to Food Sleuth Radio, where we help you think beyond your plate. I'm Melinda Hemmelgarn, a registered dietitian and investigative nutritionist on a mission to connect the dots between food, health, and agriculture and find food truth. And today I am delighted to welcome Mr. Lynn Clarkson. Mr. Clarkson serves as president of Clarkson Grain and managing director of Clarkson Soy Products. Clarkson Grain supplies selected organic and conventional grains and oilseeds to food processors. Most importantly, and why I was so interested in interviewing Mr. Clarkson today, is that he serves on USDA's AC21 committee, which addresses the snarly issue of agricultural coexistence in a time of biotechnology. Mr. Clarkson, welcome.
Thank you.
Well, I had the opportunity to listen to an e-organic webinar, and I just want to let our listeners know that the e-organic webinar series are truly excellent in giving people a good understanding of agriculture and some of the challenges that we as consumers and eaters face. And your presentation was, How Can Organic, Non-GMO, and GMO Crops Coexist? And that's what I'd like to talk to you about today. So let's just step back, and I want to just let our listeners know that you actually have degrees in political science. You're also an attorney, but you grew up on a farm in central Illinois. How did you become active in working with grain trading?
Well, as a child growing up, I associated farming with slave labor.
Right.
Largely because of the way my father employed me, and I thought it would be good to get away from agriculture. And that was followed by a number of years in college, graduate school, U.S. Navy. And I returned to the farm, started asking questions that I failed to ask as a child about how we marketed grain off of our family farms. That led to starting a company to handle direct delivery. Most farms can now hold all of their annual production on farm. They don't need commercial storage. And they can deliver directly from the farm to processors or end users or exporters. So I put together a company that would charge farmers only for the cost of handling the marketing, not for the unnecessary overhead of having an infrastructure to connect them to the markets, because the farmers already paid for that.
Mm-hmm.
So that led to a direct delivery marketing system that functioned all over the state of Illinois. Then roughly 10 years after that, I started looking for ways to avoid standing on the interstate with Cargill, Continental, Bungie, Dreyfus, Archer Daniels, who have tremendous amounts of capital and move tremendous quantities of grain, and started looking at raising food crops. Took on business with some Japanese companies, delivering to them selected varieties of soybeans to use for making tofu, miso, soy milk, soy sauce. That led to somebody coming and asking if we would assist in putting together some corn. And we managed to put together a shipload of white corn going to a foreign buyer. When it arrived at the foreign buyers, the buyer sent a telegram and said, this is the finest corn I've ever received from the United States. How did you do it? Well, in the world of agriculture, most farmers and others are used to never getting a compliment. If it's a farmer going to an elevator, he always wants to say, well, I can go someplace else if you don't please me. If it's a buyer, they normally say, you're lucky I took your material because it's not really what I want. So a compliment was something rare in the world of agriculture, and most of us like to be rewarded by knowing that what we do, people appreciate. So there was no real secret to getting good corn. We just minimized the handling. A typical kernel of corn between the United States field in the Midwest and a buyer in Tokyo might be vertically lifted and dropped a total of something like 1,600 feet. We reduced that to less than 200 feet. And the various steps in getting it overseas. So the buyers liked that. I appreciated the compliment. And then we started moving this company into addressing more and more food-grade needs of processors. So we're behind a lot of tortillas, a lot of tortilla chips, a lot of soy foods, and we enjoy those relationships.
So how many choices do farmers in your region have in terms of bringing their grain to a buyer? Are you one of many?
Yes. The typical farmer will have two or three buyers within a 20-mile radius. But if he wants to focus on food-grade corn, the noise in the background is the Norfolk Southern mainline rail to the East Coast to Norfolk. And my office sits right next to it, so it sometimes sounds like a train is coming right through the office. If the farmer wants to raise for a specialty market, then his choices of market become somewhat more restricted. There aren't that many people that prepare grain for cooking at food processors. And then if the farmer wants to raise organic, he has even fewer choices because there's just not a density of production, a density of movement to justify buyers on every corner.
Mm-hmm. And I, of course, am, as a registered dietitian, I have become very interested in the connection between how we produce our food and how that affects public health. And so, personally, I prefer to purchase certified organic products simply because I don't think we've had the long-term public health and environmental testing that is needed for my philosophical position on food safety. And you tell an interesting story in your webinar, and I wanted to share it with our listeners. And it has to do with your taking a tour of a Monsanto plant with a gentleman from Japan. And
yes.
The gentleman from Japan says, well, how long have you been doing the research on GMOs? And the researcher at Monsanto says, well, about 16 years, if I'm recalling correctly. And the Japanese gentleman looks at his watch and says, in our country, we wait a generation. That would be 30 years. Call me back after then. Tell me about the precautionary principle and your perspectives in dealing with EU and Japanese countries versus the American model.
Well, what you just mentioned is an accurate retelling of that experience at Monsanto. And the gentleman who responded that way is the president of one of the very large food cooperatives around the Tokyo metropolitan area. His company delivers to quite a few millions of people, and he's very concerned about what goes into his food supply system. And what he was articulating is the precautionary principle. If I don't know that it works, then I don't want to immediately start using it. Many folks in the United States make fun of the Europeans and a number of Asian countries for articulating a precautionary principle because we say,